Again, here we go. V'kidashta mishnasa chamishim shana krosem dror ba'aretz l'chol yoshvel. Yovel hi lochem, v'shavtem ish el achuzaso v'ish el mishpachto. All right. So what we're looking at here is that we're looking at the pasuk that establishes all of the parameters of Yovel in a very short statement. V'kidashta mishnasa chamishim shana, Yovel, the 50th year, 49th, a cycle of 49 leading to the 50th, and some say it's the 49th year, there is another Shemitah year, which means that if it's the Shemitah, if it's the 50th year, you're going to be marking Shemitah twice, one right after the other. In addition to that, it is a year of ukrasem dror ba'aretz l'chol yosheha. It's a year where you are freeing all of the indentured Jewish servants. Let's remember that when we had a session on Avdus. Let's remember that when it comes to Avdus, there are two kinds of Avodim. There's an Eved Kanani who is a slave, and we spoke about all of this. We'll come back to it someday. There's Eved Ivri, who is an indentured servant and who works for a particular period of time, and who also has the option, after the time of his servitude is over, to stay. Yovel sets all of those individuals free. Even the one who decided to stay is sort of pushed out the door. Take responsibility for your life. Trust and draw ba'aretz l'chol yosheha. And then finally, the third and the most far-reaching aspect of Yovel is the return of property. And what? Let's lay it out. When you come to Eretz Yisrael, you're an Israelite, you're entering as the nation, property is distributed to the tribes, is distributed to families. From that point on, that property belongs to you to the extent that you are not supposed to sell it in perpetuity. Property is not sold in perpetuity. Later in Bahar, the Torah will say, Kadosh Baruch Hu says, Li kol haaretz, the land belongs to me, and you are toshavim and gerim on the land, you are citizens, you are strangers on the land is not fully yours. The way it would work is cultural property would be sold, would be leased. They would call it a sale, but with the understanding at the end of a 50-year cycle, all of that property would return back to the original owner. People were not supposed to sell their agricultural holdings. They were not supposed to sell their land because land was the one thing that kept them somewhat rooted and kept them able to live. If they were forced to sell, then they knew that that land would come back to them. If at any time during that 50-year period, one of their relatives is able to redeem the land for them, or someone else is able to redeem the land for them, the seller, the buyer has to accept that redemption. And that redemption would then come give the land back to the original owner. If the person himself who sold the property won the lottery or came into some sort of windfall and could buy back the property, the buyer had to sell him back the property. So what you were doing is you were leasing land, you are leasing it for up to 50 years, depending on when in the cycle you're leasing it, with the recognition that that land would always have the potential of being bought back by the original owner. Now, this is an amazing halacha. It talks of tremendous upheaval on the 50th year if lots of land has been leased. And it talks of a society following some very rigid regulations concerning buying and selling when it comes to real estate. The thought process seems to be, and this is similar to what we said when we spoke about Leket, Shikha, and Peah, which were, if you remember, in Parshat Kedoshim, matanos, agricultural produce that is automatically left for the poor from a farmer's field. And we spoke about that, and we said that what the Torah is doing is it's again striking, and here in Yovel, I think even more dramatically, striking to that dividing line in society between the haves and the have-nots. Throughout history, it's real estate. throughout history, it's landholding that determines whether or not you are a successful individual or whether or not you're dependent upon others. Are you an owner or are you a sharecropper? Are you a landed gentry or are you someone who has to work for the landed gentry? And the Torah does not want people within the Jewish world to lose their holdings, to lose their family holdings. And therefore the Torah, and we'll see even more when we look at, when we get to the second part of this year, we'll see that, yes, we believe in capitalism, but we believe in capitalism with balance. And here the balance is a sort of recognition that we're not going to allow that capitalism to run rampant to the point where people will become landed gentry and the only ones that are holding onto property. There has to be some democracy when it comes to the ownership of property. Now, having said this, we're going to focus for just a moment on a strange exception to the original rule. And David, I don't think I have control, so if you can scroll up. Strange exception is the second is B. V'ish ki yimkar beit moshav ir choma, perfect. V'haysa gulato ad shnat memkaro yamim tiyeh gulato. So in other words, what you have here is an exception to the rule. Whereas all land outside of the walled cities and towns and villages and the agricultural land, all of that is potentially sold only for 50 years and can be redeemed at any time. If you sell a property in a walled city, Beit Ir Choma, you sell a property in a city that is walled, the opposite rules apply. You have the possibility of redemption for a year. The seller can redeem the land for 1 year. After that year passes, the buyer now has the land in perpetuity. It is sold. And it's the exception to the rule of all the other landholdings on Yovel, in that it can be sold in perpetuity. After that 1 year passes, it belongs to the buyer completely. And the question, of course, is why? Why is it that this exception is found in the Torah? And the Torah gives no reason for it whatsoever. The Torah does not say why this is the case. And I think it's a beautiful example of how different Mefarshim approached what was a powerful, powerful exception to a powerful law. We take a look at the Ramban, the next section, and the Ramban says that there are two concerns for the seller as to why a house in a walled city cannot be bought back, can be held in perpetuity. In cities, he says, what you're buying, you're in public view, you're living in a house which belongs to you and belongs to your parents and belongs to your family. There's a certain sentimental attachment to that holding. It's not just holding that you're using for agricultural need, but it's the home in which you lived. And there is an embarrassment because of the fact that you're living in the city and everybody knows what's going on if you have to sell that property. And therefore, the opportunity for immediate redemption of 1 year is there. But then at that point, you want the land to belong to someone forever. And if it's going to be in the hands of the buyer, then you're going to allow the seller to sell it in perpetuity and the buyer to hold it in perpetuity so that now it can become someplace that he lives and his family lives, and he won't have to worry about being kicked out during that 50-year period. When it comes to fields, the concern is for a livelihood. The concern is, I've got to be able to make a living. If I can't make a living on my field, then that's a different concern, and therefore that can be sold, but it has to come back to me. So it's really a question of how you view the property and the kind of attachment you have to the property, says the Ramban, that determines whether or not that field can be sold or not, and whether or not there can be a full sale in a city. Turn to the next, to Chizkuni. The Chizkuni, and again, David, scroll up for us, please. The Chizkuni says that I'm going to have a concern for the seller and for the buyer. The seller, the field, it's livelihood. In the field, it's going to be, my concern is going to be, can I make a living? Am I making it? Am I not? Can World City property be sold between tribes? I saw someone ask on the chat. My understanding is yes. Yes, it could even be sold between tribes. Now, in the case of the buyer, once again, and this is similar to what the Ramban said, I'm in the city, I want to put down my roots. I want to be able to be there in perpetuity. I want to be able to stay there. There are different concerns. So the Chizkuni and the Ramban are both talking from a practical perspective that exceptions are made because of the way we view the property. Along comes Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. And this is much later. The Chizkuni is a very early commentary. The Ramban a little bit later. Rav Hirsch, of course, almost contemporary to us in history. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch has a, and the quote here is from one of my books where I just took out the section. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch says that the whole purpose of these land sale laws is to create a kind of society. And this is the kind of thing that Rav Hirsch would say. Rav Hirsch, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, and here's an example of how to see how different commentaries will approach the text from their own bent. In other words, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch is philosophical. He talks about society. He talks about grand vision. That's his approach. And his approach is that I want to create, and you see in the quotes, a blend of town-bred intelligence and the natural, uncomplicated outlook on life fostered by connection with nature and the land. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch says, and perhaps he's talking in his world where he's beginning to see society moving away from nature and society moving away from a recognition of our dependence on nature. He says, you want to have someone who has the smarts of someone living in the town, but has the outlook, and we spoke about this last week, the outlook of the planter, the outlook of someone who recognizes that he can't just make his mark on the world, that he has to fit into the ongoing cycle of the world, lessons that those who are involved with agricultural feel very keenly, and those of us who live in cities begin to lose. And he said, therefore, what you're trying to do is you're trying to make sure that there's always going to be agricultural land near where people live. So in other words, when I come in, I have my land, I have my home, and then if I have to sell that agricultural land, I want it to come back to me again so that I can have a society that hopefully I'll be able to hold on to that land so that I can have a society that allows people to be living near where they're working the land. And that creates a society that in Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's mind blends the best, blends from the town-bred intelligence with the ethical and moral dimensions of someone living off the land. He says, only in walled cities would a population develop experientially divorced from the land. And then he says, you're going to have only in walled cities is that going to happen, where you're going to have those people who will move away from the land. But that's only a small number. And those individuals can sell in perpetuity because those individuals are going to be a stabilizing force. They're going to be the lawyers. They're going to be the doctors. They're going to be the professionals. But you've got to have this large population that has the blend of town and country, if you will. And that's Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. And it's a different way to view the laws of Yovel as creating, not just dealing with a society that is ethical and moral, but a society that is trying to balance the kinds of views of the world that you want to have balanced within your society. Finally, if we move down to the last commentary, to the Meshech Chachma, also almost a contemporary, we come to what, for me, this is an amazing interpretation. It's my favorite. I don't know if it's Pashut Pshat, but I think it speaks to us in a very interesting way. The Meshech Chachma suggests that you have to understand the importance of walled cities in the society that we're talking about. Walled cities were the first line of defense against an attacking army. They were the human fortresses. They were the fortresses, they were the buttress, they were what you were going, you, in order to conquer the country, you're gonna have to conquer the walled cities. That can be seen from the very first conquest that Yehoshua makes when he comes into the land, of course. As soon as you come, where does he go straight? He goes to Jericho. What has to happen? The walls have to fall down, because that is going to be where your first, that's your first line of defense. If you conquer the walled cities, you'll conquer the land. If that's the case, says the Meshech Chochmah, then what you need to understand is that those societies that are in those walled cities have to be well-oiled machines. They have to be, you have to be creating neighborhoods where the people know each other. You have to have people living in the city where people know where the keys to the fortress are, where the keys to the lockbox are, where escape routes are. You've got to know your city well, and you've got to have a well-functioning, cohesive community living in that city that can, at times of tremendous stress, immediately pull together and immediately respond to danger. Therefore, says the Meshech Chochmah, you can't have an upheaval in the population of those walled cities every 50 years. If what happens is every 50 years, the people who've been living there are suddenly kicked out, and people who haven't been there for 50 years are coming in, you're going to be leaving yourselves vulnerable to attack, and the walled cities won't be able to function the way they need to function. And therefore, says the Meshech Chochmah, that is why you have the exception of walled cities. It's not because, not just to create a society, not just to give care or concern for the buyer or seller, but because of the importance of those Arei Choma themselves, because of the importance of the way that they are meant to serve the society as a whole and the way they need to function in order to play that role. Now, why do I find this so beautiful? Because it has, I think, a Musar Haskel for us as well. We don't have walled cities. We're not living in the same kind of society. But particularly those of us who have lived in Golus, and more people are finding this out here in Eretz Israel, we do have cities and communities that serve as the buttress against, or as our first line of defense, in this case, not against armed attack, but against assimilation. And those, of course, are the synagogue communities, the communities we create, the focal point of our identity, particularly in the diaspora. I mean, the role that shuls play, and I, from what I understand, this is not only my experience, of course, is in the United States, but my understanding is that this is true in England and other places as well. You can tell me if I'm wrong at towards the end of the class, but the role that synagogues play and communities play in being the place to which people can return for their Jewish refueling, and to be able to serve as the place where we work together against assimilation, against anti-Semitism, et cetera, these are critical roles. And communities to do that have to be well-functioning machines. They have to be places where we're getting along, where we're not attacking each other, where the Lashon Hara is minimal, where we're cooperating. And to my mind, those are the walled cities of our time. Those are the walled cities of our time. And you can picture what it would mean if there were these total upheavals in their population, and the Meshech Chochmah comes to life. So to me, this is another way of looking at this exception. The Torah doesn't tell us why the exception is made. This may well be it, or any of the other explanations that we gave. And here you see, so if we back up for a moment, we see it approaches that have been presented by four different commentaries, two of them speaking of the sensibilities and sensitivities of the buyers and the sellers, Rav Shimshon and Fuller Hirsch giving this grand scheme of a society that combines town and country, and then finally the Meshech Chochmah suggesting that it has to do with the walled cities themselves and the role that they play in defending the land of Israel. All right. Move on. If I am going too fast, my wife tells me sometimes that I guess that when I'm not speaking to you face to face, I have a tendency to go too fast. So if I am, can someone unmute and tell me I'm going too fast? Otherwise, I'm
perfect.
Doing okay?
Perfect.
I appreciate it. I hope, all right. Now, we move on. If we move on now, we're going to a second area of study. And that is, we're going to take a look at a set of laws concerning one particular area of law that emerges from this parsha that has tremendous applications for us, and that is, are the laws of Ona'a. All right, now we're going to define Ona'a in just a moment, but let's take a look at how it appears in the text. Then we'll try to define it and understand its applications. The first is a section that comes from Parshas Bahar. All right, keep going up. I need to move. That's it. Perfect. Thank you, Dave. Kisim keru memkar lamitecha, o kana miyad amitecha, al tonu ish esochiv. This is found in Bahar, where we are talking about the sale of land. And the Torah says, when you sell to your friend, or you buy from your friend, al tonu, do not be guilty of ona'a, one to his brother. Torah then goes on to explain what it means. When you're selling the land, make sure that you sell it or you buy it with full disclosure concerning where it is in the cycle you are. If you're buying it in year one, the price will be high. If you're buying it in year 49, the price will be low. Both the buyer and the seller have to be honest and open about that aspect of the sale. Then the Torah then repeats, v'lo tonu ish es amito, the last line, and it seems like an almost unnecessary repetition. Do not be guilty of ona'a, one to his friend. V'yareisam elokecha, ki ani Hashem elokechem. And you should fear God because I am the Lord, I am Hashem, your God. And again, the word ona'a or tonu appears. Don't. Now, what does this word mean? If you look in the English, it means oppress. That's how we're going to define the word. So you have two sentences here. One which speaks about the land. Second, which is a repetition. Don't oppress your friend in these dealings. The second source where ona'a appears is actually the first source. It's before this section of Vayikra. V'ger lo tarnu v'lo tilchotzeno. And a ger, stranger, you shall not oppress nor torment, for you were once strangers in Egypt. Now, what the practical applications of that are, we'll see in just a moment. In Vayikra, it again says, Perek Yutes, a little bit before the part in Kedoshim, if a ger lives in your land, you shall not oppress him. And then finally in Devarim, lo taskir eved al adonav, do not return a slave to a master. If a slave runs away, and here we're talking about, by the way, an eved kanani, a full slave, runs away from a master, do not return him to the master. He should live with you in your society, somewhere where you choose. And then it says, lo tonenu, do not oppress him. So the rabbis, if you will look at these sources, and they derive that there are actually four different laws, or four different categories of ona'a, of oppression. If you scroll up for a moment. Those four categories are ona'at mamon, financial oppression, and that's what they gain from the first pasuk in that first source that we said where we were talking about the dealing with the land. The second sentence, lo tonu, the last sentence in that first source, they say deals with what we call ona'at devarim, verbal oppression. Ona'at hager deals with oppression of a stranger, separate law, and onad ha'eved deals with oppression of a slave. So you have the same word being used in various different contexts: financial, verbal, oppression of a stranger, and oppression of a slave. How are we to understand this concept of oppression? Now, oppression is one of those words, you know, when you think about it, you don't really apply it to yourself. I don't oppress people, or at least I don't think I oppress people. Oppression is a master over a slave, a king over a subject. How does oppression apply on a practical basis to my life? And what is the Torah telling me? Don't oppress my neighbor. And why is it using that term? So before we get to that, and I'll ask David, scroll up to the bottom of this page, please. If you scroll up to the bottom of the page, if you have it, otherwise I'll just tell you about it. There's another sentence that I brought in to help us understand how the Torah is going to approach this concept of oppression. There's another word that when you use it, you don't think of it applying to yourself. And that is the word revenge. You don't necessarily take revenge on people. And yet in Parshas Kedoshim, back in, David, I saw you move it up, please. Parshas, no, the other way. Well, I need to see the bottom of the page. It says in Parshas Kedoshim, keep going. There it is. Lo tikom v'lo titoret b'nei amecha, v'yohavto l'reacha kamocha. Do not take nekama, do not take revenge against the members of your people, v'lo titor et b'nei amecha, and do not bear a grudge. And then, of course, the famous end of the pasuk, v'yohavto l'reacha kamocha ani Hashem. So again, you look at lo tikom v'lo titor, and you sort of say, okay, v'yohavto l'reacha kamocha, that applies to me, we spoke about that, but I'm not taking revenge against people. Along come the rabbis and the Talmud. And they say, wait a minute, we want you to understand what the Torah is talking about when it talks about nekama, when it talks about revenge. And let's tell you the difference between nekama and netira, revenge and grudge bearing. And they give the following example. They say, if Reuven goes to Shimon and says, can I please borrow your ladder? And Shimon says, no. And the next day, Shimon turns to Reuven and says, can I borrow your flashlight? And Reuven refuses to lend his flashlight only because he could not borrow the ladder yesterday. That's revenge. That's revenge. Now, I could have another reason for not lending the flashlight. Maybe I need it. I could have another reason. Maybe I don't lend out anything. Maybe that's not nice, but whatever it might be. But if the only reason that I'm not lending you that flashlight is because you failed to lend something to me yesterday, and I just outright refuse for that reason, that's nekama. That's revenge. What's netira? Netira, say the rabbis, is when he comes to ask you to borrow the flashlight, you turn to him and say, sure, I'll lend you the flashlight. I'm not a bum like you who doesn't lend things out. That's netira. That's grudge bearing. Now, what would that, now, does the Torah want you to swallow the hurt that you had that you wouldn't be able to borrow from him yesterday? I don't think so. And that's why the pasuk right before this says, don't hold in things. You should talk about it. The proper way to deal with it would be to lend him the flashlight. But then when he returns the flashlight, or even while you're lending it, to say, you know, but I want you to know I was really hurt yesterday. You know, why weren't you willing to lend me the ladder? You might find out that the reason he wasn't willing to lend the ladder was because the ladder's broken, or because he needed it at that point, or because he doesn't lend ladders out because they always get broke. Whatever it may be, the point is, don't deal interpersonally with others in a realm of revenge or grudge bearing. You have an issue, talk it out, raise it, but that's nekama netira. Now, what's amazing to me is what the Torah does, what halacha does, is it takes a concept that we think of in grander terms, and it boils it right down to the nitty gritty. If I treat you in such a way simply because you treated me that way yesterday, then that's revenge. My goodness. How often do we do that? And yet how often by doing that do we perpetuate unhealthy relationships as opposed to talking something out and saying, well, why wouldn't you lend to me yesterday and bringing it out to the fore? Same idea with Nekama. Now, Netira. So I'm using that as an example of where the Torah takes something that you and I would think really doesn't apply to us. I don't take revenge. And the halacha says, well, maybe you do. And now let's take a look at oppression. What does oppression mean? And what is it that unites all these different categories? Financial oppression, verbal oppression, oppression of the stranger. So the rabbis tell me the following, that oppression is defined as taking advantage of someone or honing in on someone else's weakness. If I, in a relationship, know that you have a particular weakness or a particular sensitive spot or a particular, or in some area you are not on par with me, what it might be in terms of my situation, and I take advantage of that, I hone in on what it is that I know is going to hurt you, that is oppression. And look at the examples. Look at the examples in B of which the rabbis will give about oppression, for a verbal oppression. We're now talking not about, so we're going to the second, we have financial, verbal, oppression of the stranger, etc. We're taking a look at number B. We're going to come back to financial in a moment. Any verbal behavior that causes mental anguish by highlighting an individual's weak point falls into the prohibited category of onat dvarim. Look at the examples. Disparaging the background of a penitent. Someone who is a Baal Tshuva and disparaging their background or somehow making a comment about their background. Misleading a prospective customer about the nature of a specific merchant's business in order to embarrass the merchant or the buyer. In other words, I tell someone that he should go to this merchant, knowing full well that the merchant will not be able to help. Here's one that's really inquiring about the price of a specific object without any intention to buy. All right, let's talk about that one. That's something we all do. We shop around. But what we're being told is that if you go into a store and you use up the time of the salesman, knowing full well that under no circumstances are you going to buy that object from that person, that's ono. That's taking advantage of that person's weakness vis-a-vis you in that specific relationship. You know you're not. Now, you can go in and say, it seems to me you can go in and say, you know what, if he gives me a really good deal, I will buy from him. If he's able to meet the price, or if he's able to beat, but if you go in knowing full well, you're just, and or you could go to him and say, listen, I need you to do me a favor. I need to ask you some questions about this item. I'm not intending to buy. But if you are going to buy it, you're going to do it on the basis of, I'm going to make you think I'm going to buy that if you work hard enough. That is onat dvarim. Soliciting technical advice from someone you know not lacks the necessary knowledge or expertise. Or number five, suggesting to someone that his suffering is due to his own evil deeds. Wow. All right. I think, and this bothers me endlessly. I hear this being done all the time. This is happening because you did this, or this is happening because you did that, or this is happening because, no, you're not allowed to do that. You have no way of knowing. You have no way of knowing when something is happening. And you shouldn't assume that it's happening because of your crime. You should say that whatever is happening to me, I will learn from, but you should not necessarily or say to someone, particularly, that what's happening to you because you did X, Y, or Z. These are just, but verbal oppression becomes something where you know who's very good at verbal oppression? Husbands and wives. Husbands and wives know each other's sensitive place. The closer you get to someone, any relationship, The closer, the more you're able to put on the sensitive place where you are guilty of onatvarim, because you're taking advantage of that. All right, if someone is asking, is the sound choppy? Okay, so there we are. We're talking about verbal oppression. Thus becomes, any time that I am involved with someone else where I have the ability to strike to their sensitive point, to strike to where they are, anybody, that becomes onatvarim. That becomes oppression, verbal oppression of others. The statement that I have for you next is very beautiful, and it's again Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, appropriate. What about midah keneged midah? Yonatan asks. Usually why we suffer, because of midah keneged midah, where Hashem is punishing us for what we did. Again, I believe, and I think this is what Chazal are saying, that anytime something happens to us today, we have no way of knowing why that's happening. It could be because of punishment. It could be because HaKadosh Baruch Hu has other reasons. We have no right to assume that it is because of one thing or another. We can, at some point say, what is happening to us should teach me to be a better person. What's happening to me should move me to explore. But I can't say to someone else, certainly, and even to myself, it's happening because, with a certainty, you know, because you did that, that's why this is happening. We have no way of knowing that. We have no way of knowing whether we're dealing with midah keneged midah, or we're dealing with what I would call nisayon, where Hashem is testing us. Cheshbon ha-nefesh, correct. That's correct. That's what our cheshbon ha-nefesh should be, that whatever happens to us, we should do cheshbon ha-nefesh, but that doesn't mean that we know why it's happening. All right, the rabbis will say that onat dvarim, does this apply to blaming the community, Judy wants to know. I think so as well. In other words, I think it should be, I'm not blaming the community, I'm looking at things the community can do better. Those are two different ways to look at the same coin, one positively and one negatively. For someone to get up and say, it's happening because of your lashon hara, I don't know that. For someone to get up and say, you know, we should look and see what's going on within our communities and become better people so that whatever challenge is facing us will move us to cheshbon ha-nefesh and improvement, that's a very different approach. And I think that unfortunately we sometimes step over that line. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai says that onas devarim, that verbal oppression, is more severe than financial oppression. And that is because if you look at the paragraph we had before, when verbal oppression is spoken about, it mentions v'yareisam elokecha, you should fear God. It's not mentioned by onat mamon. It's not mentioned by financial oppression. Other rabbis will bring other reasons that they feel that verbal oppression is more severe. One of them is because you can, financial oppression, you can always pay back whatever it is you, and once something is said, you can't take that back. So these are reasons, and Rabbi Elazar says, one is that financial oppression is against your money, verbal oppression affects you as a person. So verbal oppression is something that we should be very, very careful about, and that is taking advantage of someone else because they are, we know their weak point. The next two areas of oppression, the ger and the eved, really there are three different kinds of people that the Torah is referring to there. If the Torah says that there is a specific prohibition against oppressing someone verbally who is in a weak societal point. And those are ger, eved, ger toshav. A convert, a non-Jew living in my society, ger toshav, and an eved kanani, and someone who is a non-Jewish slave living in my society. These are all people within the strata of my society who I could conceivably take advantage of verbally. I could turn to the ger and say, you're really not one of us. I could disparage. And by the way, having been involved with gerus, As a Rav, I've said this to you before. Number one, Geirim say that the community could do better in terms of accepting them and making them feel comfortable. But the whole process of Geirus allows itself or tends to allow for abuse even before the person becomes a Geir, because the person's dependence upon our society to accept them and our ability either to make that very difficult or to make that welcoming, depending upon the circumstance, puts that individual at a point societally where they are very weak as compared to those they're dealing with and very dependent. And most of the Geirim that we've dealt with are individuals who are at a point in their lives where they're looking to move on, and this is a step they want to take if they're really sincere. And it's important that we learn to treat them with respect. And if they are actually serious about the process, they deserve tremendous respect. I said to you before, we say in Al HaTzadikim, in Geirei HaTzedek V'Yoleinu, the people who choose to become Jewish and do it for the right reason, I have found are exceptional people in many cases. And it's something we should be very careful about. What is financial oppression? So here the rabbis, based on this pasuk in Bahar, where we spoke about how you sell land and the disclosure of where you are in the cycle by both the buyer and the seller, the rabbis come up with an equation which says that the biblical prohibition of onat mamon basically forbids deceptive pricing. And what do I mean by this? Basically, here are, and then we'll look at the parameters. When I'm involved in a sale to you, and you are buying, if either one of us has knowledge that what is being bought or sold is either much more valuable than the other person thinks, or much less valuable than the other person thinks, and we don't disclose that, we're guilty of onah. We are guilty of oppressive, deceptive pricing. And it falls into the category of oppression. It falls into the category of all those things we spoke about, because I'm taking advantage of someone else's weakness, taking advantage taking advantage of someone else's weakness. Now, what are the laws of Onah? All right, somehow I think, did this change the screen here? Yeah, there we go. All right, the laws of Onah are as follows. If the difference between the price paid and the actual market value of the item, looking at number one, is less than a sixth, the sale is final and no recourse exists. If the difference between the price paid and the actual market value is exactly 1/6, the under or overcharged amount is returned to the victim. Now stop there. What we're dealing with is, I'm selling you a painting. And I know that this painting, market value of the painting, or market value of this bottle of water that I'm selling is X. And I charge you a sixth over the market value of that item. Or vice versa. You walk into somebody's garage sale and you see that someone is selling a painting which you recognize as a Rembrandt, and you say, oh, that's a nice hand painting there, and you try to buy it for much less than it's worth because of your knowledge, you're guilty of onah. If it rises to 1/6 of the market value, okay, then that sale is still valid and there's no recourse because that amount of overcharge is acceptable. If it's over a sixth, then the sale is invalid. And the man can, either the buyer or the seller can back out and come back and say, you had information that you didn't share with me, and therefore the sale is invalid and I want my money back, or I want or if it's the seller who's been cheated, I want my object back. This is true only in a case where I am not being open and honest. If, for example, you come into my store and I have a bookstore and you say, I want to buy that book, and you say to the person, you know, in any other, truth is it's really only worth X, but that's the last copy I have and I'm only going to sell it to you for Y, and you agree to buy it at that overprice, then that's not ONA. It's only when I am not being open and honest with you and I'm taking advantage of your lack of knowledge. You look at section 5, the time period during which now, there it's not open-ended. I can't come back 3 years from now. I can't come back 4 years from now. It has to be that I have to have enough time to know that I was cheated, but after that time passes, no. 6, the laws of ONA are not dependent on intent, even if the deceit is inadvertent. I didn't know that I was underpaying. I didn't know that I was overpaying. Nonetheless, this has to be fair. Now the market price, if you look at 9, the market price of commodities is determined through factoring of a wide array of issues. In other words, what I will sell an object for, or what the market price of a value of something might be, if I'm selling it from a store that's in a high market where I'm paying a huge rent, or I'm paying a huge overhead, so perhaps I'm going to sell it for more, and that's the market price under those conditions. But it is determined by geographic location, personal service, et cetera, et cetera. Now let's stop for a moment. Look how far we've come from the kind of oppression we were talking about before, where I'm verbally hurting you, where I'm verbally affecting you. Now we're talking about taking advantage of you in the marketplace. And the Torah uses the same word and binds it into the same area of law. And what the Torah is basically saying is, look, we want to create a society where you never take advantage of someone else's lack of knowledge, where you never take advantage of someone's lack of strength, where you never take advantage of someone's weakness, be it financial, and we will take all of those cases and we will put them under one category. And that one category is expression. One category, and that category is oppression. Question on the chat. Why is there an exemption dafka for real estate transactions? Excellent question. And I'll make the question even more, I was going to come back to that in a moment. And I'm going to make the question even more sharp, because we're learning the laws of ONA from real estate. We're learning it from Yovel, where we're dealing with the source is not letting someone know about the 50 years, where I am in the 50-year cycle. So apparently the rabbis say that's an exception because that's not the real estate value that's at stake. That there I'm dealing with an objective issue. I'm dealing with where am I in that? So that's not deceit concerning real estate. That's conceit during the, I'll come back to that, Yonatan, in a moment. That's not dealing with real estate concerns. That's per se, but dealing with a lack of openness concerning an objective issue. Now, why real estate transactions are generally exempt exceptions to this? Because I believe, according to the way Chazal see it, at least in the time they were dealing with, and I think it may be true today, real estate is not, it's not easy to compute the value of a particular real estate to someone, to that individual in an objective fashion. People are willing to buy certain things in real estate because of their own particular needs, which will allow them to pay more or less. It's not an objective kind of commodity. And therefore, the laws of ONA did not apply to real estate, would not apply to other kinds of things that are subjective in their value as opposed to objective. Yonatan said, nah. Yonatan, someone on the chat said, there is a possibility of deception in real estate, but it's not ONA. That would fall into Gnevas Das. Let me just point out that ONA is only one area of law concerning buying and selling, and that is overcharging or undercharging due to a person's lack of knowledge. You have other areas of law. that will be very specific when it comes to the kinds of merchant buying and selling that we're involved in. For example, you have genevas das, where I'm stealing someone's mind. Let's say the Talmud will talk about a case where I'm selling vegetables or I'm selling fruit, and I put the beautiful ones on top and the ones that aren't so good on the bottom. That's not allowed. That's deceit. That's leading someone, that's stealing someone's knowledge. That's making them think that the entire box that I'm selling them, and by the way, I think we've all experienced this. Some of you have on the chat have said that this is the kind of thing that happens. You're right. And this is why the Torah is trying to forbid it. The Torah is saying these are not the kinds of things that we believe should be taking place in the marketplace, that the marketplace should be a place of morality. The marketplace should be a place of honesty. Capitalism, so if someone would ask, does Judaism believe in a financial system of capitalism? The answer is yes, we believe in free enterprise, we believe in free trade, we believe in the marketplace with restrictions. We believe in fair trade. We believe in being honest. We believe in not deceiving someone. We believe in any type of deceit or taking advantage of someone's lack of knowledge is immoral. And in this case is to be considered oppression because I am oppressing that individual by taking, in fact, I'm going to read to you a paragraph from my book that I just took out because I think it sums up. I'm going to quote myself. Of course, a wide breadth of life experience, the uniform laws of Onah remind us that oppression can take many forms, from the halls of commerce to the treatment of converts, from the commodity trading floors to the marketplace of ideas. The Torah uses consistent terminology to carry God's demand for ethical behavior across all walks of life and to make one point abundantly clear. The weak will always be protected through the full force of Jewish law. And that's really what it comes down to. What it comes down to is the Torah is going to want to protect the weak. The Torah is going to want to protect those who are in any given situation have the lower hand. And the Torah is going to say, don't oppress, don't take advantage of the upper hand. Be honest, be clear, whether it's, and be sensitive in the area of verbal communication, because otherwise you'll be guilty of this overall prohibition of Onah. Okay, so we've covered a lot today. We dealt with a view of Yovel a bit. We dealt with the exception of Ir Chomah, of a house in a walled city. And we dealt with this concept of oppression, which has all of these various different applications. We could talk about any of this at a much greater length, particularly the financial one, where I just outlined the overall parameters to you. Have a good day, everybody. Have a good week. We'll see you, please God, next week.